Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
My name is Sean Evans. Ando Kanchi is my dharma name. I wanted to dedicate the talk to all of our teachers. Succession of Bodhisattvas and Buddhas. The lineage of tea ladies on the side of the road. The lay people, the priests. We come from a beautiful extended family. To begin, Dogen's teacher, Rujing, said the beginning of Zen study is to have the heart of the way. Coming and going without beginning or end, like ever-changing white clouds, the heart of things. The second part of that was someone I consider one of my teachers, Zen priest, poet, artist. She lived in 1791 to 1875. Her name is Rengetsu. And when I discovered her, and we were at Tassajara in 2019 for the practice period, I felt that a whole doorway opened up, that a woman that long ago had been a priest, had been a poet, had been an artist, and that she made 50,000 ceramic pieces, 50,000. She inscribed a poem on each one. And I believe when Rujing said, having the heart of the way, that she had the heart of the way. And now a quote from Norman. Leaving home means setting aside all we know, all that is secure, authoritative, comfortable, and binding. Shoving off for parts unknown with no roadmap, no guarantee of finding our. To go forward, you must leave everything, everything behind. And even though the past may be persistent, lodged as it is in our very bones, it's one thing to be bound up in the past, doomed to repeat it, or to be held back endlessly, and quite another to use it as a springboard for a journey that goes beyond. To where one can never know. This quote from John Sutherland, Roshi from the Pacific Zen lineage. Compassion isn't a commodity we deliver, but a commitment to help liberate the intimacy already in any situation. So liberating intimacy, the heart of things, ending up in a place we can never know. Leaving and coming home for parts unknown, in my life, no roadmap, no guarantees, my Dharma journey, learning how to help and be helped, to offer love and receive love. I've had to learn that. A commitment to compassion. Compassion as the springboard. Continuous effort, not turning away, one mistake after another. All my ancient twisted karma. The heart as my guide star. The heart of the way. So if you would, close your eyes for just a second, and I want to do some imagining. Ask you to imagine with me. Imagine a grassy meadow in the deep green Oregon woods. You're walking toward a huge white canvas wedding tent, completely enclosed by gauzy white screens. A sign, Meditation Hall, hangs over the entry flap of the tent. This being your first 7-day non-Zen retreat, you know it will certainly be different than a sesshin. The theme of the retreat is living and dying, being taught by Stephen and Andrea Levine, spiritual teachers from New Mexico, sort of Buddhist-Hindu hybrids, offering teachings and practice about how to be with people as they are dying. And rather than turning away from them out of fear or putting them in institutions where medical professionals can give them end-of-life care, they're going to teach us how to be with people. So there you are, you're approaching this big tent, you're carrying a black zafu. You hear murmuring voices and shadowy figures are moving out inside the tent, and a pungent cloud of incense, not Zen incense, but very sweet Indian incense, hits you like a ton of bricks as you come through that flap of the tent. And you look around and, whoa, wait a minute, what's this all about? The scene looks like a movie set, a battlefield hospital tent. But instead of wounded soldiers in uniforms, there are dozens of patients, females and males of all ages and sizes, flat on their backs on gurneys, propped up in chairs or spread out on massage tables. They're wearing striped pajamas and football jerseys, knitted caps, baggy yoga pants, and still others are sitting in beach chairs low to the floor with arms and legs splayed, hands and feet resting on pillows. Their attending caregivers hover nearby, mostly wearing aprons with lots of pockets over purple and red and green tie-dyed t-shirts, blue jeans, shorts, bandanas wound around their necks and their heads, feathers and ribbons in their hair, and then posted around the edges of the tent, a few like real doctors, real only in that they have stethoscopes on. But I can't really tell because they're actually batting balloons around between them, joking and laughing, checking in with a caregiver now. Are going to talk to a patient in the middle of the room. You can open your eyes. A web of clotheslines are strung around from one side of the tent to the other, just above our heads, laden with stethoscopes, ACE bandages, water bottles, drying towels, diapers, wiping cloths, crystals, and prayer beads. This was the retreat I attended in July 1985, a year after leaving the Zen community of New York, soon to be on my way to Baltimore, where I had accepted a teaching fellowship in nonfiction writing, a graduate program at Johns Hopkins University. I had no idea what I was going to write, And I really didn't think I needed or wanted an advanced degree. But I didn't have a community to go back to because the Zen community of New York had closed. We had lost the lease on our monastery. And our business was in transition. What I had failed to read in the description of the retreat, I don't even know if it was included at all, was that many of the retreat participants would be receiving terminal care during the retreat. Of the 80 attendees inside the tent, more than 30 were so close to death that I could feel that energy of people on the edge of their seats, counting the breaths. Each person had a caregiver trained, completely devoted to them and volunteering their time. The seating arrangement was helter-skelter, with no organized sitting rows, only one, and one other person had placed a black sofa on the floor, and that person turned out to be Yvonne Rand. I don't know if any of you know or knew her. So she and I were the two Zen renegades there at this fantastic retreat. We had no idea where we were, really. And it just began suddenly in a sprawl, this sort of psychedelic crazy quilt, human body parts and blankets and pillows and wheelchairs and metal walkers and bedpans and ivy drip poles. And on a slightly raised stage, covered with rose petals, two red zafus waited in the center, side by side, surrounded by a 4-foot-high blue-faced medicine Buddha. And then two large statues, one of Hanuman, the monkey god, and the other of Ganesh, the elephant god. And then a 6-foot-high cutout of the Dalai Lama holding hands with one man. This was not a Zen Zishin. This was something that seemed like a fantasy to me. But that scene inside the tent would shove me off to the next step, toward parts unknown, to where I could never have known. So those of us who didn't have someone we were assigned to, there were about 20 of us who had just come into this retreat. For some reason, you know, karmically attracted to it, to learn about living and dying. Suddenly, Stephen and Andrea appeared on stage. They bowed and greeted everyone, rang a few bells, and then we were plunged into silence for 10 days. Each morning and each evening was opened with a gratitude meditation, especially thanking those participants who were so openly and so bravely sharing their last days, their last hours, and also giving thanks to the generous caregivers, reminding all of us to pitch in and care for each other silently. Every one of us is dying in this room, they told us, morning and evening. So please take refuge together here in our predicament of life and death. Inside the tent, inside your breath, inside your heart, take refuge. Though I had a bed in the dorm room like many of the others, I mostly fell asleep in the same place where I was sitting all of the day. Meals and snacks were served in a nearby garden shed for those who were ambulatory, and others were hand-fed in their beds or their chairs. And sometimes during the meditation time, moans of pain or a sudden gasp would pierce the silence. Sometimes an oxygen machine flicking on, and then the rising and falling of inhalations and exhalations. There might be the sound of bowels letting go, Pampers paper diaper being changed, a whispered request for a bedpan or a sip of ginger ale. And then some sobbing, maybe, quiet laughter, a whoop or a whimper, sometimes great fear. Sometimes a curious bird would flow in, or a bat. The bats would come around 7 o'clock as the sun started to go behind the trees. And although I know some people didn't like the bats, we grew to sort of expect them and love them. And some of the people who were so sick began to coo to them, cry to them. It was a hallucination, and it was very, very real. There was a frail young man I was seated next to who had had no caregiver. He wrapped himself in blankets and pillows, sitting inside a big rubber inner tube, which was probably a big truck tire somebody had given him. And despite the summer heat, he was clothed in sweatpants and fleece jacket, puffy down mittens, ski hat, scarf, big woolly socks. His head was lowered with eyes always closed, never acknowledging, nodding, glancing at anyone else for the whole 10 days. 4 people died during those 10 days. We had ceremonies. They were kept in the tent for the first 24 hours, and then they were ceremoniously carried out. And on the final day of the retreat, Stephen asked us to turn towards someone near us and offer something of ourselves that felt intimate and caring, something he said that felt like a stretch. The whole thing had felt like a stretch, really. But when I turned to this young man, I asked him if he'd like a foot massage. And without even looking at me, he said, "You wouldn't want to massage my feet." I said, "Well, try me. I'm not being selfless. I really like foot massages. And I figure if I can give you one, you might give me one." He didn't smile. He didn't turn towards me. He simply began to unroll his big sock. Bright purple polka dots covered his very swollen foot. And he pointed to his instep. "See that one?" he said. "That's the first one I ever got. And it was shaped perfectly like a heart." And though I didn't know the technical name of what caused it, I knew he must have this new terrible disease, AIDS, the new deadly plague circulating around the world. Remember, it was 1985. It was the very beginning of that epidemic. And as I massaged his feet, I learned his name, Gilly Gilkison. His real name was Harold Otis Gilkison. He was 46 years old, born and raised by a Swedish father and an assimilated Lakota Sioux mother on a Nebraska farm. He had a career as an emergency room nurse at San Francisco General Hospital, where he had worked for 2 decades until a few months ago when the throbbing nerve endings in his hands and fiery shooting pains in his feet made it impossible for him to work any longer. I helped nurse a lot of my friends dying in their apartments, he said. They were too ashamed to come out on the street. They didn't want people to know what they had or see how hideous they looked. They all died terrible deaths. Most had pneumonia, couldn't get their breath, panicked, drowning in their own mucus, frantic, scared. I just wanted to help them, he said. And I thought this retreat might help me with whatever this is going to be next. Probably the same. We stayed in touch by phone over the next 6 weeks. Gilly went back to San Francisco and I went on to Baltimore. We had spent the rest of that day together, rubbing each other's feet, talking about our lives. He told me that he was ready to die if he had to, but that he had one regret, and that regret was that he actually couldn't nurse any more of his friends. He developed pneumonia, just as he predicted. He was hospitalized once in San Francisco, but then he refused to go the second time. His breath grew weaker, more labored during our brief phone calls, until one day when a friend answered, telling me Gilly was in an oxygen tent and could no longer talk. He died a few days later, cuddling his beloved Jack Russell Terrier named Tonto. So Gilly's little purple heart led me directly to the next Zen teacher, disguised as an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Hospital. When I arrived for the fellowship, I found Dr. Frank Polk, who encouraged me to study immunology, epidemiology, and infectious diseases. And then he supervised my dissertation on emerging retroviruses. And after the degree program was over, he asked that I write a hospital handbook on AIDS patients and their caregivers. And then he made up a job called AIDS care coordinator and hired me. And he gave me these orders. He said, find a way to be of help. It's an epidemic, you know. Ever since, I've met many other helpers, everyday bodhisattvas of all kinds. And just two to mention briefly, these are early, wonderful AIDS friends. Don Schmidt, extraordinary AIDS policy activist from San Francisco, who said to me, you don't have to like everybody all the time, Jean. You just have to work with them. And it helps if you love them. And then my friend Larry Peck, director of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, wrote a newspaper column in Albuquerque, New Mexico called I'm Living with AIDS. It was very daring in those late 80s. He survived a firebombing in his home. He and I worked together, co-facilitating Shanti trainings, which again, some of you may know of because you were San Franciscans, and you were probably part of the AIDS epidemic and the helpers. And he could come into a room and he was just like a 1,000-watt light bulb. He could light it up. But he would say to the volunteers at the end of our Shanti trainings, don't use my death for your resume. Don't make me feel like you're superior to me just because you think you're not dying. Your only job is to give and receive love, he would say, nothing else. So Larry's life had been full of terrible abuse and violence. At the age of 5, he had watched his father beat his 2-year-old brother to death at the dinner table. His mother committed suicide when he was 12, and he was sent to foster care with a family who tried to deprogram him from being gay. But by the time I knew him, he'd worked his way through college. He'd worked as a dancer at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. He'd fulfilled his dream of becoming a child protective services worker, an organizer of gay men's health parties. He'd gotten a master's degree in physics. He was affectionate and full of mischief. And he would often say to his friends, "Love you, mean it." During the last week of his life, he invited all of his friends from all over the country to stay at his house, and we slept on the floor. We bathed him and changed him. We ate takeout food from the places he loved. We watched his favorite movies on tape. And one night, when we were all certain he was dying, including him, Larry said his goodbyes, and we sat with him in a vigil all night as his breath sputtered and chugged. But he woke up in the morning. He looked around us and said, "Am I dead? Or am I alive?" When we laughed, he said, "Still here." "Okay," he said, "I saw my baby brother and all the helpers on the other side, and they're having a very, very good time." Two hours later, Larry quietly died. And we asked ourselves, are we the helpers on the other side? What kind of helpers are we? I've worked as a helper. I know many of you have worked as helpers. And it's critically important what motivates us. It's at the heart of our practice, part of the world. How do we offer our help? What kinds of attitudes and communications are really helpful? Helper who has vowed to save all beings, an impossible vow. All of us doing our best, trying to contemplate our next steps. Who are we? How do we want to be of help? I'm thinking of the old Zen story, Layman Pang and his daughter, Ling Zhao. And as they were out selling bamboo baskets, the layman stumbled and fell. And when his daughter Ling Zhao saw this, she ran to her father's side and threw herself on the ground. "What are you doing?" cried Layman Pang. "I saw you fall, so I was helping." "Luckily, no one was looking," remarked the layman. In a commentary on this story in The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries by Enlightened Women, contemporary Zen teacher Joan Sutherland writes, "Ling Zhao's action obliterates the idea that there's a helper and a helped. Compassion isn't a commodity we deliver, but a commitment to help liberate the intimacy already in any situation." What is most intimate? Usually the most intimate response to another's difficulty begins with the willingness not to turn away, not to flee. Fleeing can take the form of abandoning the situation, and it can also mean escaping into this helping. I am the helper, you are the helpee sort of thing. So intimacy, being willing to stay and listen and accompany, be vulnerable, be surprised, be flexible. It's a willingness to fall down with someone else and see what becomes possible when we do. And usually no one's okay. Layman Pang's final line doesn't mean he's worried about some third person judging the event. The one who fortunately isn't looking is ourselves. That is, we have a chance to let go of that inner tendency to monitor and pass judgment on ourselves, distancing ourselves from interactions. How free it is when we aren't keeping score. How generous a life lived with no one's looking. His daughter's gesture suggests we're all falling together all the time, lifetime after lifetime, through the universe right now, falling through this world. As we fall, if we pick and choose instead of accepting life all as it is, we're refusing the invitation. What are we doing? Norman asks us repeatedly. What are we doing? Are we falling down together? Not turning away when things are painful? Are we liberating the intimacy in all things? As we study and practice together, let's ask this question of ourselves and each other. Let's pay special attention to our hearts. Norman also often says, what matters most is the state of your heart. What is the state of your heart tonight?
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.